Are you ready, Jim?
Yeah, we're ready.
Okay. So we're on the last topic, the home run. We're going to get Mark to give us an overview.
Okay, thank you, Ian. The final issue for today relates to the accounting for restocking fees and related costs. Restocking fees are fees that a customer may pay upon return of a product, and entities often charge restocking fees to cover any costs related to the return, such as repackaging of the product, or to compensate the entity for the reduced selling price that it can charge to another customer for the return product. So with respect to the question about how the entity should account for the restocking fees, there seems to be a couple of views in practice. The first is that the restocking fee should be included as part of the transaction price when control of the good transfers. So you can think of that either as a fixed component of the initial transaction or as a reduction in the estimate of variable consideration, in this example, variable consideration being the estimate for returns. The second view is that the return of the product is a transaction separate from the initial purchase, and that the restocking fee should be recognized when the product's actually returned. And then the third product is that the restocking fee creates a put option at a price that's lower than the original selling price of the product and should be treated as the transaction should be treated as a lease. The second question relates to how the costs associated with the return product should be accounted for. And again, and there's three views, the first view being that the restocking fees should be accrued when control of the product transfers in the original transaction. The second view is, again, for those who view the return of a product as a separate transaction from the initial sale, that those costs should be recognized when the product's returned and the costs associated with the return are incurred. And then the final view is that the cost should only be accrued if there's an expected impairment of the return product. So if the expected costs related to the returns are greater than the restocking fee. The staff view on this issue is that the restocking fees should be included as part of the transaction price when control of the initial product sale transfers, and that the cost should also be accrued as a reduction of the asset recorded for the right to recover a return product when control of that product transfers. So said more simply, both the fee and the cost should be considered as part of the initial transaction with the customer. Staff think that a restocking fee is essentially no different than a partial refund for a return product and should be treated similarly. Staff also think that the guidance in 606.10.55.27 or B25 of IFRS 15 on when costs associated with a return product should be recognized is clear, and that those costs should be accrued upon the initial sale of a product. Recognizing the related restocking fee when control of the product transfers is, again, most consistent with that guidance. So thinking about treating both the fee and the costs similarly. So with that, I'll turn it over to the TRG.
Okay, thank you. London, any comments? Gary?
Yeah, just a question to the staff. When I'm reading paragraph 17, by the way, I do agree with the conclusions in here. It seems like the accounting for the costs is driving the revenue answer, at least the way the first sentence there is reading. Is that, you know, the intention, or is it?
I think it's a consideration. I think that's one of the reasons we think that's the appropriate answer. But I also think, too, it is important that the other point that I was trying to articulate is that there doesn't seem to be in substance a difference between a return where the customer is subject to a restocking fee versus a return where the company or the retailer, the entity, says that they will only reimburse the customer for 90%, for example, of the sale price of the product. We think those two things are essentially the same thing and that they should be treated for similarly. So in the example of a partial refund, of course, you would consider that as part of the initial transaction price when you're estimating your returns. So we think that a return subject to a restocking fee should be treated similarly.
Yeah, no, I'd like to say I agree with the answer, and there's a couple ways to look at it, but essentially it's an adjustment of the sales return reserve. You know, it's not a, you know, it's net of, you know, the incremental revenue. So I agree. Then this is just an observation, and you don't need to respond to it. But I'm very glad view C did not prevail. But when you think about trying to make accounting easy, no one in the world is going to think of this as a put option on a lease.
John Smith would have.
well, John Smith's not here right now. But I mean, we just talk about over. The mere fact we're thinking about it, and I'm glad we rejected it, but, you know, we're not just overthinking. You know, no one's going to think of these things as a lease to borrow something you return for 2 weeks. You know, I'm sorry.
I was about to make an impassioned defense of UC.
You're a wrestle.
obviously the last topic.
I'm very happy with the approach taken by the paper. If we're talking about, you know, retail kind of scenarios where a large proportion are not coming back and a small proportion are coming back, I guess I'd make two comments. One is, I think when it talks about the costs being accrued, I could certainly agree with the idea that the cost should be recognised in the income statement at that point by writing down the asset for the recoverable item. I'm not sure that I think you actually need a liability for those costs. I think that probably the cost should be accounted for when incurred. It's just that the P&L effect will be recognised up front by writing down the asset, not by accruing a liability. But the other thing that probably would occur very infrequently, but if you were to generalise from this paper to a business that, for example, sells yachts, and in a good year it sells 2 yachts, and it sells them with a right of return but subject to a restocking fee, I don't think I would get to this analysis. I think if somebody takes a yacht and has the ability to return it and forfeit 15% of what they paid, I probably do think that's a lease, actually. But it's only in those relatively extreme cases.
Okay, Andrew.
Thanks. Similarly, fairly comfortable with where the paper gets with one proviso, because I think that economically it looks very much like a 90% refund. Having said that, view B also seems possible because there's a bit of tension between the guidance in B21A that prohibits the recognition of revenue for items that are expected to be returned, and then guidance in paragraph 55. And view C, we would really just rule out. The only other thing, and it links back to the question of can you recognise revenue for something that you expect to be returned, which would then imply that you're not recognising revenue because you don't think the control's transferred, even though physical possession has. And does that mean that the restocking fee doesn't actually fall within the revenue standard at all? And then it then becomes some other kind of income instead. And this was the only sticking point that we had on it when we looked at it, that perhaps this is something where there would need to be a little bit of thought of the interaction between control passing and getting revenue recognized and getting some other form of income.
Philippe.
I'd like to go back to the example of the yacht. This happens, I'm a bit familiar with that kind of problems.
You returned your yacht.
Yeah, I just came back from that. If I borrow a yacht from a ship broker and I pay a fee for that lease, which is proportional to the time of the lease and the value of the boat, yes, for sure that's a lease. Maybe a short-term lease, which is out of the scope of our standard, but in nature it is a lease. Now if I buy a boat and I decide I don't want to have it and I return it with a fee that is fixed, it's not based on the time I've been using the boat, I find it hard to see it as a lease because it has nothing to do with the period of the borrowing or the lease term. So maybe substance over form could help here. If it is really a form of borrowing, of renting a boat disguised as a sale with a right of return, or it is a lease with an option to buy in the end. Maybe then I could see those cases, maybe a lease, but it's very rare and very specific.
James. Thanks, Ian. To echo what others have said, I'm very comfortable with the paper. For the exact same reasons that Andrew alluded to, I don't think I could cross out view B in question one. Particularly with the paragraph that refers to not recognising revenue on something that's going to be returned. It has been alluded to already on question two. We talk about in view A, which is where I am, but restocking fees should be accrued. I don't think that's a liability. I think it should be taken into account in how we measure the goods coming back.
Good. What's the effect of that? Because both of you have said it. That if you reduce your revenue by the amount you think is going to be returned on one hand, but you don't take up a liability for the cost of dealing with that, then you'll reduce your revenue now and you'll increase your costs later, won't you?
It's the difference between whether you carry the asset that's going to be returned at 50 with a liability of 5 for the costs, or you carry it at 45. Yep. So there's no P&L difference, it's just a balance
sheet.
And I think, I mean, but do you have any problem with the wording in the application guidance around how it says you account for that right to recover the asset?
I didn't think I did. I haven't been back and checked. I didn't think it said, I didn't read it before as accruing liability.
No, that's right, yeah.
It says take into account those costs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Any other
comments? Just to be clear, when we, and maybe it's poor terminology, but when we say accrue, we do mean as a accrue as a reduction of the return right asset.
Well, that clears that up.
Sorry, that may not have been clear in my remarks, but that's how we frame it in the paper.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments here? Tony?
Yeah, just to confirm, we're also comfortable with the way the paper is laid out, the conclusions and the reasons for the conclusions. I think to the conversation that Philippe and Phil had, I think there's enough in the standard around a significant economic incentive to exercise a put right and so on to get you to a sensible answer when something might actually be a lease rather than a return. And so I think in the context of this paper, that's a red herring, but I think there's enough in the standard to get to sensible answers.
Good. All right, over to you, Jim.
Comments here? Mark?
I think I agree with everything I heard, so I don't want to belabor it. I mean, we were view A in here, and but I did hear, I think, someone saying they can't rule out view B. I would think that if, under the staff's view, what they wrote up here, view B is ruled out, right?
I would think so. I mean, view B for no other reason. I think we'd roll out view B for no other reason than it creates an inconsistency between when you're accounting for the restocking fee and the related costs. So for that reason, we had a strong preference for view A.
Others here? Nothing? No other comments here, Ian?
Okay, well, that makes it pretty easy. I think everybody's more or less in agreement with the paper. We cleared up the cost thing, I think, and the extreme circumstances can be dealt with. Other parts of the standard. So that's a useful paper and gives a bit of clarity. That leaves us, Jim, do you think we should find some more questions? It's only 5:45 here.
We have a vote. I think you put in a day.
Okay. Closing comments. I think the staff will go and work on a couple of the papers. I didn't hear anything that immediately calls for standard setting action. Some things that might have to be brought back to the next meeting, I think. Some things that will be circulated for a bit of clarification after the staff have had a look. Have I missed anything here?
No, I think we've the third issue we spoke about today, the portfolio practical expedient, that was an issue whereby we will circle back to a subsequent discussion. I think we're going to follow up the discussion around the completed contracts of transition with some examples. And obviously some of the other issues will be captured in the meeting report of today's discussion, which will be circulated in due course.
All right, good. Over to you, Jim.
So, Ian, I agree with that. I do think that the transition is one where perhaps we need to make sure to be very clear about what we mean. It's important in terms of its timeliness so that people can move about transitioning. One way I think to at least think about that question is, if you're using modified retrospective, did we mean for your P&L in the year after adoption to look identical to someone's P&L who had done the full retrospective? And I think if we answer that question yes, that sort of tells you what to do. If we answer that question no, we just need to be clear about what are the different effects. And so that might be a way to frame it as we think through examples. One more point on that, Ian. I think we can get the examples and circulate that to the TRG prior to the next TRG meeting. We may need to, at that meeting, then confirm if we don't have a mutual understanding of what the words mean, then talk about it there. But perhaps we can do it in an offline process as well. We lost. Can you hear us, Ian?
Just saying, we're all going out to dinner. What are you guys going to do?
We're not going to dinner yet.
All right. Thank you very much. I think it was a productive day.
Thanks, everyone.